Good morning. This is the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Bob Martin. We're here again reading from this week's Independent, dated Wednesday, March 7th, 2018. We begin with the news section. The Libertarians are coming. And they're not old white dudes looking to skim out on their taxes. In November, Robin Pegram decided to make a change. Pegram, a 24-year-old Apex native, had been a Democrat, but the party's handling of Bernie Sanders' candidacy and the HB2 aftermath left her feeling alienated. Pegram had always been interested in libertarianism. "I had always kind of prided myself on being a free thinker," she says. So she switched. A few months later, Pegram made another big decision. She filed to run against State Representative Nelson Dollar, the seven-term Republican whose district covers parts of suburban Wake County, because she wanted to be a voice for the people, and she believed his seat was winnable. In 2016, Dollar barely eked out a victory over Democrat Jennifer Perrell, and Democrats saw his seat as both vulnerable and vital to breaking the GOP's veto-proof supermajority in the House. But both Farrell and Wake County Commissioner Matt Calabria bowed out after a last-minute Supreme Court redistrict ruling that left them outside District 36. The only Democrat in the race now is Julie Van Hafen, the president of the Wake County PTA chapter. Enter Robin Pegram. District 36 is growing, and it's very flippable, she said. At the very least, even if I don't win, I'm at a position to make a difference, to provide a voice to those who support my ideas, to provoke thought and offer solutions to the problems that we have today. Pegram isn't the only Libertarian with high hopes for 2018. She's one of a record number of Libertarian candidates running for office in Wake County, a trend party official chalk up to voters' dissatisfaction with the two-party duopoly and a growing Libertarian presence across North Carolina. Statewide, the party is fielding 6 congressional candidates, 21 state House candidates, 15 state Senate candidates, 4 sheriff candidates, and 4 county commissioner candidates. In all, 50 Libertarian candidates are running for office in 2018, including 16 in Wake County. The people of North Carolina deserve real choices in voting booth, and we have an amazing number of people who have made the commitment to serve, wrote Libertarian Party of the North Carolina chairwoman Susan Hogworth in an email announcing the party's record-setting slate. In an environment dominated by political expediency, the growing energy in the LPNC tells us people want something more. According to Wake County Libertarian Party Chairman David Ulmer, the interest has been unprecedented, and some of its enthusiasts unexpected. Although most people associate the party with an older white male crowd, Ulmer says the local chapter is also drawing younger and sometimes center-left members. "There used to be this label that we only attract older white guys who don't want to pay their taxes," he said. "I'm excited because I have people that I would have, based on their demographics, considered possibly left of center left, coming to the Libertarian Party. It seems to have, in the last year and a half, struck a chord with people who might traditionally vote Democratic if there was no Libertarian on the ticket. It's not entirely expected." Perhaps no one represents this dynamic better than Pegram. A lesbian, Pegram says she was disappointed in the Democrats' handling of HB 142, the HB 2 replacement that passed last year with the support of a number of North Carolina Democrats, including Governor Cooper. While the bill eliminated the controversial bathroom provision, It left in place a nearly four-year moratorium on local governments passing anti-discrimination laws. In a lot of ways, it can feel like when you're in the Democratic Party and you're in the LGBTQ community, sometimes you feel like a prop so that officials say one thing during the campaign, but do another one once in office. I just wanted to get away from that completely. Like Omer, Pegram says she's seeing her fellow millennials express interest in libertarian ideas, which helps her wave away concerns that she doesn't fit the party's traditional mold. I'm not too worried that I don't really fit what it usually looks like to be a libertarian, she said. I think there's a new wave coming. When I say new wave, I mean including more youth and women and LGBT. These people are becoming more politically awakened. Still, it's hard to say and if any of these trends will affect the upcoming elections. As of March 3rd, there were 4,621 registered libertarians in Wake County, according to the State Board of Elections, to compare to 4,526 in 2017. Pegram is optimistic that she can defeat Dollar, but she'll have to vastly outperform the libertarian candidate who ran against him in 2016. That year, Nelson Dollar won District 36 with 49% of the vote. Brian Irving, the libertarian, won 4%. Any sort of libertarian movement in North Carolina, in fact, will face an uphill climb. Libertarian presidential candidate Gary Johnson received less than 3% of the vote in 2016. Sean Ho, the Libertarian Senate candidate, garnered 3.6%. But Omer and others are optimistic that even if none of their candidates are elected in 2018, the Libertarians will change the conversation, especially in Wake. Wake County is one of the most purple counties in this county. In a purple state, Omer said. So to say that our message and our voters won't have an impact is not really correct. We will have an impact. And I would argue that our participation and our messaging and who we will pull from will likely decide the outcome of those races. The two parties don't want to admit that. They don't want to acknowledge that we're existing. They are trying very hard to ignore what's happening in Wake County, because once you begin to acknowledge you have a legitimate third party on the ballot competing, winning votes, and changing the conversation, you have to address that. The next news article, Divine Wrath. Students say Duke Seminary needs to be more LGBTQ friendly. Last Wednesday, the dean of the Duke University Divinity School gave her State of the School address, an annual affair that rarely generates headlines. This year was different. A group of LGBTQ students and faculty and their allies interrupted Elaine Heath's address in an effort to call attention to what they say is the real State of the Divinity School, that is, that it's less than welcoming to gay and trans students. What's more, the protesters say, the school has declined to address their demands, which include the implementation of a non-discrimination policy and clearly marked gender non-specific bathrooms. The protesters say that professors are unequipped or unwilling to deal with queer theology, and that LGBTQ students who want to engage with those issues aren't given the resources to do so. In addition, they object to the lack of LGBTQ faculty and what student Nicole Williams describes as don't ask, don't tell policy that pervades the school. All the while, the students complain. The school advertises racial diversity and highlights its gay and queer students. On their list of demands is a queer theology course, which students want the school to offer starting this fall. But theology professor Mary Fulkerson, faculty advisor to the campus group Sacred Worth, which seeks to increase awareness of LGBTQ issues, is in the church, says they already have one, and she teaches it. Maybe we need to change the title so it's more obvious, she said. The class, Sexuality, Bible, Church, and Controversy, explores sexuality, gender, and how to think about those concepts while reading religious texts. Williams says the course doesn't cut it, although Duke Divinity School has certain courses that include quote-unquote queerness. They're not a specific course geared around queer theology, she said. Duke Divinity was founded 92 years ago and is still supported by the United Methodist Church, which is perhaps why the school has not more explicitly embraced LGBTQ students. Fulkerson says she also thinks the affiliate is part of the reason her course is titled opaquely, for fear of offending Methodist students. Gays and lesbians cannot be ordained in the Methodist Church, unlike in the Presbyterian Church, says Fulkerson, a Presbyterian minister. This isn't the case at Wake Forest School of Divinity, which openly and unequivocally supports LGBTQ students, despite its historical ties to the Baptist Church. Wake Divinity is an outlier among seminarians in the South, according to the Institute for Welcoming Resources. It's one of only 17 seminaries in the nation, and three in the South that are welcoming to LGBTQ students. Overall, Wake Divinity is a very welcoming and affirmative environment, says Jerisha Saunders, president of Wake's Divinity Pro-LGBTQ Campus Group, Kaleidoscope. Most students explicitly affirm the dignity and unique contributions of LGBTQ people to theological education and to Christian life in general. A few individual students do not fully affirm LGBTQ in their theologies, but Wake Divinity creates an institutional culture of respect. At Duke Divinity, however, it's a different story, Williams said. There's a general hushing of LGBTQ people. Last year, Williams said students rallied to gather signatures for a petition for a queer theology course. But the second the petition was handed over to the faculty, it disappeared. This isn't representative of the university as a whole, Williams said. It's more of a Duke Divinity School in-house thing that is systemic to the place, she said. At times, Duke Divinity School can seem like this isolated place from the greater university. The students have focused their ire on Heath, the school's first female dean, who says the student protests amount to disrespect shown to my leadership. Beyond that, Heath hasn't addressed the tensions, save for a statement to the Herald Sun that all students, including LGBTQ students, are an integral part of the Duke Divinity School community. Fulkerson says she sympathizes with both sides. I feel for the students who feel that they are being marginalized, she said, but I also feel for Dean Heath. I believe she is doing as much as she can. Our next article, No Place Like Home. A program that moved four families from a homeless shelter into their own homes won't fix Durham's affordable housing crisis, but it could be a start. Wearing the light blue uniform of Healthy Star Academy, six-year-old Alia Shore bursts through the door into the sunlit kitchen of her home in North Durham and takes off her shoes. "Home, sweet home," she exclaims, arms outstretched, her sock-socked feet sliding on the brand-new tile floor. It's Aliyah's first time seeing this home, a multi-unit, two-story home on Delbert Avenue, and it's the first home she's had in about 4 months. There's a lot to explore and a lot to unpack. She zips through the house, pausing to investigate closed doors and unpack doll clothes, frosted flakes, and cleaning supplies before something else catches her attention. "Yes," says her mother, Leanne, "she's always this organized." Soon they get to Alicia's room, her own room, and Leanne asks what she thinks. Alea grabs her mother's hands, and they spin together in a circle on the empty floor. "Ring around the rosy, ring around the rosy," Alea sings. Thanks to a year-long effort by the Durham nonprofits Families Moving Forward and Reinvestment Partners, Alea and Leanne and three other formerly homeless families now have a place to call their own. It may amount to a small dent in the pervasive problems of housing affordability in Durham, where 45% of renters pay more than 30% of their income toward housing. But for these 10 people, it's a deeply personal solution that may see them from homelessness to one-day home ownership. The project is a first-of-its-kind endeavor for both groups. Reinvestment Partners bought the house in 2017 and completely gutted it, while Families Moving Forward identified families in its shelter, helped them to arrange housing choice vouchers to supplement the rent, and coached them on being good tenants. The families, all headed by single women raising children aged 15 and under, get an affordable place to live, a year of support services from Families Moving Forward, and a built-in community of neighbors they grew close to during the most trying times of their lives. There's not only one silver bullet that solves this affordable housing crisis, says Catherine Phil, Director of Special Projects for Families Moving Forward. We need to be willing to look outside the box and be willing to approach different solutions. For these four families, and any that may come after them, it's everything. It's big even though it might seem like just four families. Just off of Horton Road sit three dozen nearly identical homes. They were all built in the mid-1960s and share the same combination of brick and gray or beige siding, broken up by symmetrical doors and windows. The multi-unit homes have different owners, some local, some out of state. They're all valued at about $175,000, about $25,000 below the median home value in Durham, a number that, according to real estate website Zillow, has risen 7% in the past year. But the house on the corner of Delbert and Marne Avenue stands out. "These are amazing, aren't they?" asks a teenage boy, cutting across the yard with a friend on a Sunday, Tuesday afternoon. A fresh coat of yellow paint hints at the updates inside. Bright orange shutters frame windows that were boarded up 3 years ago. "It was stripped down to the studs," says Peter Silkern, Executive Director of Reinvestment Partners, which bought the house in early 2017. At the time, it had been vandalized and left to deteriorate. There are several vacant homes in the immediate area, and the organization hopes to buy and rehab more. The house got new plumbing, windows, and fixtures. Like any renovation project, Skillern says, it came with some headaches, and then the clients hugged me. Reinvestment Partners, which has a broad mission centered on community development, has purchased and rehabbed buildings before, particularly in the Gear Street area where its office is located. But that is the nonprofit's first rental and first-time talking house choice vouchers, which paid a tenant's income-based rent payments with federal dollars. That's where Families Moving Forward, its largest provider in homeless services in Durham, comes in. They don't develop housing, and I don't do case management for homeless families. But both are needed for these families to succeed, Skillern says. It's not just bricks and mortar. It's not just services. But when they combine, now we have a winner. Families Moving Forward shelter serves 21 families at a time, as many as 100 each year. The goal is to house families within 90 days of entering the shelter, but that's not a hard deadline to leave. The time each family in the Delbert Avenue house spent with FEM before getting keys 2 weeks ago varied from weeks to months. Timing was crucial in selecting the tenants, Pleil explains. Not only did they have to qualify for a housing choice voucher, also known as Section 8 vouchers, they had to have a voucher that would be applied to a two-bedroom unit and have that assistance secured in time to move. That they had become friends during their time with MFF was serendipitous. These families have been brought together through shared experiences of abuse, eviction, and uncertainty, but also through their children, who became playmates at the FMF shelter. Their methods of coping with their newfound living situation and the resolve to move past it. You feel a dignity that you might not if you moved into another kind of place, Pleil said. I think it's so important to people on their way up in life. They're going to want to stay in a beautiful place like this. They built a network with each other. Angel Vic Lewis and her next-door neighbor in the new house formed a bond during their time at the FMF shelter. Jane, not her real name, had been there longer since August, but the two shared a past of escaping abusive relationships. A mother of five, grandmother of 13, and former teacher, Vic Lawrence was drawn to Jane and her brand-new baby girl. Even though they had therapists there, we had one way of coping with different things, she said. Me, Miss Angel, and another lady or two have the kids, went to bed, and we'd get in my room and listen to music and vent to each other, ask other solutions and ideas. We made a pact to stay in touch with each other. Neither had stayed in a shelter before, Vic Lewis says that she first moved in. And she cried every night. Just 3 years before, she had been living in a middle-class life in a four-bedroom home in Maryland, working as a teacher and taking her young students along to deliver food and clothing to the homeless. Following her son, who was a student at NC Central, Vic Lewis moved to Durham to continue a career as a motivational speaker and use her experience to impress upon young people the importance of getting tested for HIV. She said she learned she was HIV positive because her church offered testing, and she took advantage of it. She lived in a two-bedroom apartment near Hope Valley and became entrenched in her community, inheriting from a previous resident the duty of doling out sweets to neighborhood kids. I was the candy lady, the grandma of the neighborhood, the babysitter, the hairstylist, she recalls, surrounded by piles of family photos and clues waiting to be unpacked. When one of her grandsons got in trouble at the apartment, she was given 30 days to get out. She enlisted the help of friends and service providers in her search for a new home and found nothing she could afford. So she and her 15-year-old grandson, whom she had taken care of since he was a toddler, stayed in a hotel for 2 weeks before space opened up at the FMF on December 23rd. For the first month, she was shocked to find herself in the same position as the people she had once helped. Then I sat and realized, what am I crying for, she said. I was actually never homeless. I always had some place to lay my head down, and it was always somewhere space safe. It was a rough 2 months, but I thank God for everything that I went through. Her time with FMF, she said, was a blessing in disguise, a sentiment her neighbors echo. FMF's program, the NEST, Neighborhoods Experiencing Success Together, also includes a self-sufficiency program and employment help for adults, and fitness, nutrition, and tutoring programs for kids. Through the Nest Egg, as the Delbert Avenue issue is known, the families will continue to receive caseworker and wraparound services for a year to help ensure their long-term stability. Jane moved to Durham from elsewhere in North Carolina in June 2016 after she hurt her knee and could no longer work as a city bus driver. She and her 9-year-old daughter lived with friends in their car and with fellow church members before moving into the FMF shelter in August. She applied for jobs but was turned down when prospective employers learned she was pregnant. Her second daughter was born 5 weeks ago. According to Pleal, about 60% of the shelter's guests at any given time are children, about half of whom are under 5. Last year, FMF served its highest number of teenagers ever, 20, although she cautions that is still too early to determine if that's indicative of a trend. The majority of the time, it seems like there were 40 kids, Jane recalls. Mayor Steve Shewell, in his first State of the City address last month, announced plans to map out a strategy for ending children's homelessness in the next few years. Unlike for homeless veterans, the federal government doesn't allot Section 8 vouchers specifically for homeless families with children, creating a system in which homeless families may compete with already housed families for vouchers. While the city has effectively eliminated homelessness among veterans, there were 220 homeless children in emergency shelters in Durham in the 2016-17 fiscal year, up from 172 the year before. These figures don't include those housed in domestic violence shelters. Across the country and in North Carolina last year, about one-fifth of people experiencing homelessness were under age 18. In Durham, families accounted for about 28% of the homeless population in 2017, down from 33% the year before. It's hard trying to make sure you're able to provide for your kids and keep a stable mind at the same time and try to figure it out, Jane said. Sometimes you just have to take it one day at a time and see where it all goes from there. In addition to the challenge of finding a job, Jane struggled to find a home she could afford, even with a $941 voucher. Sometimes, she said, the difference came down to the cost of electricity, which is built into the voucher's value, but often not into rent. Even though there are a lot of apartment complexes in Durham, it's not easy finding one that will take the voucher, she said. Although the Durham Housing Authority's allotment of vouchers had grown in recent years, though it has flatlined at 2,791 since 2016, and the number of landlords under contract has gone up, tenants and service providers frequently report difficulty finding a place. Much of that has to do with the process, says Janet Exio, co-director of the Community Empowerment Fund, which works to fill gaps in housing services. Tenants with a voucher can search for a unit through several websites, but it's up to landlords to post information about those properties. Volunteers at the CEF help voucher holders navigate the process and have found that many properties simply aren't listed. As of this writing, one of those sites, GoSection8.com, had just one active listing in Durham with a fair market rent in line with the nest egg houses, $990 per unit or below. While the number of landlords renting to voucher holders has increased from 135 in 2010 to 523 last year, that doesn't necessarily reflect how the number of units is changing. According to Danita Johnson, DHA's Housing Choice Voucher Program Director, it takes voucher holders an average of 130 days to find a unit and execute what's called a housing assisted payment contract with the landlord. About 5% of the DHA vouchers are being utilized, but that doesn't include recipients whose vouchers expired before they used them. As of January 31st, 125 voucher holders were looking for housing. Research by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development suggests that homeless families with vouchers fare better than families that receive other interventions. A three-year-old study of 2,200 formerly homeless families who were randomly assigned different housing and services found that families offered a voucher continued to be significantly more food secure and experienced significantly less economic stress than families offered the other interventions. While heads of households with vouchers saw lower employment numbers, they also experienced less stress and substance use. Children missed less school and daycare and exhibited fewer behavioral problems. Homelessness and shelter stays were reduced even when the study ended. Because Durham's rental market is so strong, there's not much incentive for many landlords to take vouchers. They can get just as much or more from non-subsidized renters than the fair market rent values HUD assigns to a voucher, all while avoiding the added bureaucracy of DHA inspections and the cost of bringing their properties up to snuff. Service providers also say there's a stigma that voucher holders will be more likely to damage their units. That's kind of what we saw as a real opportunity and need, Skillern said. We can make sure we're providing four more units in the pipeline for homeless folks. Leanne and Leah Shores had been living in their two-room apartment with their car broke down, relying on public transportation to get to work, pick up Aliyah from school, and get home. Leanne couldn't work enough hours to keep up with the rent. She started selling her belongings, but it wasn't enough. They got evicted. Anybody who could be where I'm at, a couple paychecks away, anybody could me, she said. A spot at FMF opened up the day before they had to be out of their apartment. I was scared to death when I got there, she said. I had nothing. Basically, I had sold everything I had trying to keep up with my rent. So when I got there, for about 2 days, 3 weeks, I didn't know what to do. Like her neighbors, she's thrilled about her new apartment and all the stuff that comes with it. She said she nearly fainted when she saw the washer and dryer. But for these families, what this house represents goes beyond its walls. At least for now, giddy from the move, they seem energized. After months of uncertainty, they can picture their futures. Leanne plans to pick up more hours working at the embroidery company, Royal Threads, put away her tax refund, and save up so she can pay rent in advance and buy a car. As soon as she can, Jane plans to start working as a school bus driver, save up for her car, and buy some clothes. Vic Lewis's eyes light up at the prospect of decorating her new apartment. Her walls are already lined with family photos. And she wants to get back to helping those in need. I understand what it means to be homeless more than when I helped people who were homeless, she said. I'm going to always give back to the FMF. I've seen the needs and the wants firsthand. A lot of people come in here with no hope. And if they listen to our stories of how we got out, maybe it will give them more oomph. And now from the Artificer column, Art Attack. Obama portraitist Kehinde Wiley and Amy Sherrod's work is neither racist nor strange. It's evidence that black life in a white supremacist country is necessarily conceptual. Presidential portraits tend to be conservative affairs, but Barack and Michelle Obama's were not the first family to choose artists whose style was at least as pronounced as their skill to capture them for posterity. Chuck Close, whose hand is immediately recognizable in the flurries of tiny marks that composes photorealist images, painted Bill Clinton. If you were looking for presidential portrait controversy, it wouldn't be a bad idea to look at Close, whose reputation is in jeopardy after sexual harassment allegations against him surfaced late last year. But while Close's pictures of Clinton hangs untroubled in the National Portrait Gallery, controversy recently surrounded the first African-American artist invited into it. Kehinde Wiley, a 41-year-old New York-based painter, was the main focus of the backlash, not for his vivid portrait of Obama, though Sean Hannity, in a bizarre and now-deleted blog post, thought he found secret images of sperm hidden in the painting, but for something Wiley painted 6 years ago that conservative media and online commenters called racist. But Amy Sherrill, the 44-year-old Baltimore-based painter, who also criticized her for her cool geometric wake for Michelle Obama, which some deemed insufficiently lifelike. Taste is taste, but presidential portraits are not regular art. Their purview is necessarily collective, not private. They can't stand simply set and obey their own rules. Their aesthetics are inseparable from politics, and they inevitably become referendums on American vision and values. The ideas that Wiley's art is racist and Sherrill is not objective rest on a patently white supremacist view of what image means in the context of Eurocentric art history, the very view Wiley and Sheridan's work is calibrated amid and against. The criticisms of the artists don't hold water, but they are revealing of the systemic forces African Americans must contend with. The national outcry against Wiley found a significant site at our own North Carolina Museum of Art. In 2012, the museum purchased Wiley's Judith and Holofernes. The offending painting, it's one of two Wiley old paintings, depicted a fashionably white black woman holding the severed head of a white woman, embedded in the vibrant floral heraldry that famously suffuses his portraits, including that of Obama. Judith and Holofernes is based upon an art historical reference that has been rendered by Europeans from Donatello to Botticelli over the centuries. It bears no direct relationship to the presidential portrait. But based on some responses, you'd think Wiley had painted Obama cradling the severed head of Donald Trump. Last month, when NCMA used the unveiling of the Obama portraits to proudly highlight the Wiley work in its collection, there was enough positive response to sustain hope for the American capacity to appreciate challenging art. But there was also more than enough negative feedback, some overtly racist, to cause alarm. According to the museum, it received a steady stream of calls, Facebook messages, and emails from appalled citizens who wanted to know how the museum would feel about the painting if the races were reversed. Those private complaints found plenty of public expression on social media. A Twitter user called Billy Anderson, at bloody...bill, whose feed is a textbook alt-right, captured the prevailing sentiment of the detractors when he asked, "If he painted a white woman brandishing the head of a black woman, can you imagine the outrage?" When NCMA tweeted a picture of a 3-year-old African-American child during a Black History Month tour, Anderson also tweeted back a horrifically racist cartoon. Others complain, if usually in less veritable terms, on NCMA's Facebook and Instagram pages, making plangent or indignant comments about the museum condoning racial violence. NCMA reported a reply with a blog post explaining the context of the painting, but if it changed anyone's mind, there was no evidence of it. This needs no context. A black person beheading what looks like a white child is not art, tweeted at rebel.front. It is a threat. That last part might be the only thing the naysayers are right about, but the picture is not a threat of actual violence, Rather, it is a symbolic threat to white supremacy. Wiley, who is known for painting contemporary African-American men in a heroically proportioned Renaissance style, is bending a violent image from art history, which is rife with them. And no one hears conservative commentators decrying the many depictions of the rape of the Sabine women, for example, to the needs of a country that is re-examining the violent underpinnings of even its most benign-seeming traditions. Wiley's painting, like many before it, is based on the story in the biblical book of Judith, which Protestants consider apocryphal, in which a beautiful widow gets an invading general drunk and decapitates him. In the paintings of yore, the scenes were often used particularly illustrating the danger of feminine wiles. But Wiley hijacks it for completely different purposes. Looking at it this way, Judith is able to destroy a hostile, more powerful entity with his desire for her. By recasting Judith as a black woman, Alifernes as a white woman, Wiley turns the story into an explosive comment on how white culture's own lust for and rapine of black culture might be turned against it. Is this idea revolutionary? Yes, by definition. Is it frightening? Of course. Revolutions always are. But it does not suppose anything about the nature of a certain race. Rather, it vividly describes, with an aggression that is quite understandable if you take the merest glance at history, a real condition of modern American life, a deeply ingrained social structure of white vampirism on black culture and labor. Is it racist to describe a race, but it is not racist to describe the world as we find it? If the image is shocking, well, art has to get your attention in order to do anything. This mandate, combined with the urgency of the issue, is why it is not okay, but necessarily for Wiley and others, to paint images that shock us. As for whether it would be okay were the races in the painted reversed, no, of course not, it's right. But only is it absurd to expect fairness toward white people after centuries of grotesque unfairness toward black people. But any such parallel, presuming a level playing field, is nonsense. An existentially threatened population depicting violence against a dominant one is not morally the same as the opposite. It's the difference between resistance and tyranny. Wiley and Sherald are part of a current African-American vanguard described from the likeness of Barclay L. Hendricks, who are decolonizing the Eurocentric canon and redefining black representation on their own terms. Sherald does this in her unique way in her portrait of Michelle Obama, which may not have the warm grandeur traditionalists crave from the first family portrait, but which powerfully represents the careful neutrality African-American women must cultivate to be taken seriously and stay safe. Like Wiley's Barack Obama portrait, it represents new waves of seeing that must be accepted into whatever default tourists have in mind if we are to keep redefining the American scales toward equality and justice. Why did the first African-American first family choose artists that were conceptually rather than strictly representational? Because they have great taste, for one, but also because black life in America is necessarily conceptual. It has to be to create space in an oppressive dominant culture, one built on condoned racial violence that representation alone merely replicates. When the baseline of reality is considered white by the powers that enforce those borders, you need something more than simple reality to make yourself seen, heard, and felt in your authentic humanity. You need the piercing subjective vision of a Wiley or Sherald. And now from the indie screen section, science fiction. Everyone's excited about A Wrinkle in Time becoming a film, but would its author be? Over Eggs Benedict at Durham's Guglielmo Bakery, former Duke writing teacher Christina Ascunas is trying to describe her decades-long association with the author besides some of the strangest, most beloved children's fantasies ever. It wasn't quite a friendship, but more than an acquaintance, says Ascunas. A mentor in some ways, whatever you want to call it. It was something for which I'm tremendously grateful. Ascunas, who retired from Duke last year, is talking about the late Madeline Lingle, author of the classic 1962 novel, A Wrinkle in Time. An offbeat combination of science fiction, fantasy, and religion wrapped in a coming-of-age story, it's the tale of a young girl guided by cosmic beings to save her scientist father from an evil force on a distant planet. It predated the likes of Harry Potter by decades, winning the coveted Newbery Medal and the occasional ban from school libraries for its allegorical look at good and evil. Asheville cartoonist Hope Larson created a best-selling graphic novel adaptation of it a few years ago, and now there's Disney's $103 million film coming out this Friday, directed by Ava DuVernay of Selma, with an all-star cast including Reese Witherspoon, Oprah Winfrey, and North Carolina's own Zach Galifianakis. In the early 70s, Ascunas certainly didn't have Disney's resources when she scripted a few low-budget adaptations of scenes from a book for Maryland's public television. She still has the production on massive videotapes, and she's never converted those to digital format. It was part of a series to be shown in schools to encourage children to read, Ascunas said. Madeline came to Owings Mill to videotape a little introduction to the program, and that's how I met her for the first time. Lingle and Ascunas' paths crossed several more times over the past few years. First at a writer's conference in Bloomington, Indiana, then at an Episcopal retreat in New York City. She was a staunch Anglican Episcopalian. Her office was in the Cathedral of St. John the Divine for a long time, Ascunas said. The three pillars of the Anglican Church are tradition, faith, and reason. There's a strong intellectual tradition in that faith, and that was part of what drew me to her. So we had similar intellectual vision and came to an intersection of science and religion and an interest in cosmology. The combination of science and religious allegory in Lingle's work resulted in blowback from some religious organizations, which sought to have her work banned. That always surprised me because I thought, wrongly, that Christians would have loved to have this spectacular novelist writing for young people, Ascunas said. She's much less religious than C.S. Lewis in The Chronicles of Narnia, but it suffuses the work, if you're looking for it. The two remained in touch after Ascunas moved to Durham in 1984, regularly exchanging letters and occasionally meeting up for religious and writing retreats. Lingle sometimes visited the area. I vividly remember her getting her to sign a book at Durham's intimate bookshop when I was 10, and then provided a rare blurb for Ascunas' 1993 novel, The Dream of the Stone, a YA fantasy with several parallels to Wrinkle. I had the audacity to ask her if she would read it. I think I'd been a little older at the time. I probably would have been too afraid to ask, says Ascunas, who's currently finishing a new adult novel set on the Outer Banks. She told me, "I will give you a reader's reaction, not an editorial reaction. I will always be so grateful for that generosity." Lingle, who passed away in 2007, was wary of her works being adapted to film. Of a critically derided The Wonderful World of Disney version of Wrinkle that aired in 2004, she was quoted as saying, "I expected it to be bad, and it is." I asked her one time before she sold the film rights if she would like to see A Wrinkle in Time made into a movie. She said, She was unhappy that she would not have the control, the creative control, that no one let her have veto power over what they were doing. There are very few adaptations I feel live up to the books, with fantasy especially. The film looks exciting, certainly. The director is remarkable. But there's many kinds of ways that it could go wrong. That said, Eskunas believes Lengel would have had no problem with the most controversial change the film makes to the book. The protagonist, Meg Murray, is a biracial child, plays by Storm Reid, and the film had an overall Afro-Furious vision that should get a strong tailwind from Black Panther. This has sparked outrage from groups complaining about social justice warriors and the appropriation of traditionally white characters through diverse casting. As far as the appropriation issue goes, Lingle would have absolutely have spoken out in defense of the fiction writer's right to inhabit the consciousness and being of any other character, no matter how different from herself. That's just an imaginative leap that all writers make. Eskunas hopes that no matter how the final film turns out, it draws people back to Lingle's work and the messages within. I think that it is a very timely story to have a young girl confronting the forces of evil, Eskunas said. I keep thinking of Emma Gonzalez, the Parkland shooting survivor. Young people like her are the real-world equivalent of the Lingel heroine. There are young people today who need stories about standing up to darkness and winning, and understanding the price of victory. Also from the screen section, Mourning with Dignity. In Sebastian Lelio's superb Oscar winner, a bereaved transgender woman in Chile fights for her personhood. Sebastian Lelio's A Fantastic Woman is a melancholy and philosophical portrait of a transgender woman's fight to mourn her partner's death with dignity. At the beginning of the film, we meet Marina, Daniela Vega, and Orlando, Francisco Reyes, a happy May-December couple living in a posh apartment in Santiago, Chile. When Orlando suddenly dies, Marina is forced into various confrontations with her partner's family as well as with the state, which does not recognize Marina's gender, much less her right to be treated as her lover's kin. Throughout the film, Marina struggled to partake in the smallest tokens of mourning, like attending Orlando's funeral, becomes a fight for existence itself. Through a succession of the smallest aggressions and the least abasing indignities, we witness Marina's repeated assertions of her personhood. With cinematographer Benjamin Erzate's camera often trained on the protagonist's face, the film is a study in Vega's superb expressiveness. Her face registers exquisite sensitivity through the blankness of traumatic shock while also transmitting a palpable warmth and wit. Rapidly displacing from her formerly protected life, Marina is pushed further and further to the margins of the city. Long tracking shots capture her lanky form walking through immersed terrain, from glittering urban skylights to graffiti-strewn peripheral neighborhoods, and we notice how starkly urban space indicates who is included and who is excluded, who is normal and who is abnormal, and who gets to be a citizen and who does not. In the ugly attacks that Marina withstands, the film also reminds us that Chile's history of fascism, not fully in the past, still finds expression in patriotic rage against so-called aberrant gender expressions. The desire to torture, punish, and control perceived deviant movements' lives on in the most intimate aspects of family life and the most quotidian routines of bureaucrats and law enforcement. Despite the film's unflinching portrayal of the realities of transgender life in Chile, it's no miserables paean to suffering. The delicate violin score and crisp cinematography underscore Marina's unyielding will to live. If one of the defining tropes of the 20th century art film was a glamorous alienated woman walking across war-ruined European metropoles, Marina might be the defining figure of the 21st century. A woman fiercely holding on to her personhood when multinational capital has determined humans on the global periphery to be basically disposable. And now a look at the indie food section. Float like a hummingbird. Chef, restaurateur, and all-around boss lady Colleen Speaks cultivates good vibes with her Raleigh Cafe and cocktail bar. I'm perched on a bright yellow stool, cupping a mug of coffee and admiring a sunlight spilling into the white marble bar when I hear a voice behind me. "Are you hungry?" asks Colleen Speaks, the chef and owner of Hummingbird, a cafe and cocktail bar that opened last November at Dock 1053 in Raleigh. "I haven't eaten yet. Do you eat everything? Let me put you in an order for a few things," she said. "Our order includes the daytime only sticky bun, whose tender dough and heady butterscotch sauce is everything I dreamed it would be." Noticing my obvious delight, Speaks says that to her, "There's nothing better than serving someone food and making them happy." And it's all the sweeter now that she's fulfilling her life dream of owning a restaurant. It's what inspired her first job bussing tables at Massa's, an Italian joint in her hometown of St. Louis, Missouri, and to move to New Orleans to pursue a degree in accounting at Loyola University, knowing that it would serve her well as a future business owner. After graduation, Speaks interviewed at three Big Six accounting firms, but quickly realized that her interests lay elsewhere. She returned to the restaurant life, honing her chef chops at restaurants like Emeril Lassange's, Nola, and the Bluebird Cafe. After a decade in New Orleans, Speaks decided the Big Easy wasn't so easy. In 2001, she moved to Raleigh, where her sister lived. Speaks worked on places like Bloomsbury Bistro and under chef Ashley Christensen at Torteca Inn, catering dinner parties on the side. Speaks' personal life took off, too. She met and married her husband, bought a house, and started a family. As her family grew, so did her catering biz. She rented a kitchen behind the restaurant Finches, and 5 months pregnant with her second child, officially launched Posh Nosh Central in 2007. Well, that's about it for another week. This has been Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And a reminder, this program will be available as a podcast following its initial broadcast. So, until next week, goodbye, good night, and good morning.